Good morning, everyone. I wonder if we could just say a thank you again to Sue and to all of those who've taken part in the dramatized reading. I've certainly enjoyed it. I think we all have. Can we give them a round of applause as well? Okay, so I haven't done a whole lot of research, not into what we've been looking at this morning, but into what I'm about to say by way of illustration. But it seems to me that maybe in the last 10 years, there's been something of a rise in the number of anti-heroes that there are in films and TV and in books. By anti-hero, I mean heroes who lack the traditional characteristics. If you want to flick on, by the way, to the next slide, here are some of them. The traditional characteristics of a hero, things like courage or integrity or morals or self-control, those kind of things, they're sort of flawed in some way. Now, of course, the anti-hero has been around for quite a long time, even Arthur Conan Doyle's creation of Sherlock Holmes. He solves all these incredibly difficult and complex mysteries, and yet he, in the books, is a drug addict. But recently, there just seems to be more, for whatever reason. And the most common type of anti-hero that we seem to see is the one who lacks morals, the one who will do whatever it takes to achieve their goal. Now, their goal will be honorable, it will be a good thing to desire, but they're willing to break laws, or willing to steal things, or even willing to kill people, all for the greater good. Now, this morning we come to the end, as we said, of our summer series in the book of Esther. And as we've gone through the book, we've mentioned again and again that although God is silent, he appears silent in this book, he's intricately weaving seamless, seemingly unconnected and surprising events into his plan for the world and the universe. Now, this morning I want us to think about this a bit more. And what we'll do is we'll focus in on our two main characters, on Mordecai and Esther, who, I put it to you this morning, suffer from the same problem as many of our modern-day anti-heroes. They, too, do morally wrong things to try to achieve their goal. So the story again, very quickly so far, Haman in his hunger for respect and fear has, because of Mordecai's failure to show these things to him, successfully conspired to have the king issue an edict that goes throughout all of Persia to annihilate all the Jews. Mordecai hears this, persuades Esther to help. She pleads before the king. The king's angry and embarrassed that someone would undermine his authority by attacking the people of the queen. And then Haman is hung on the very gallows he's prepared for Mordecai. So the story finishes today with Mordecai being given, as we saw, what Haman had. He's given, firstly, his estate. And then in verse 15, as John showed us, we see Mordecai leaving the king's presence in royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. Then in 9:4, we read Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. And then at the very end of the book, in 10, verse 3, Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes. Now, it's quite a dramatic transformation, isn't it? Just a few weeks ago, we thought about Mordecai the man wearing sackcloth, weeping and wailing at the king's gate with ashes on his head. And then there's a quite dramatic transformation for Esther as well. She's transformed from this lowly Jewish girl who follows her uncle's every command to a woman who in 9 verse 29 assumes her queenly role
and writes with the full authority of the crown to institute the festival of Purim. Now, our story finishes with Esther and Mordecai seemingly blessed by God with power and authority in this kingdom that they're exiled in. It's very surprising, isn't it, for exiles to rise so high? And of course, they're not the only biblical characters to arise to prominence in exile. Daniel is another example of someone who does so. But Mordecai and Esther are quite different from him. Daniel is faithful to God, he's righteous, and he's moral. He is a hero. Mordecai and Esther are not. And again, like our modern-day anti-heroes, their drive, their goal, their reason for doing all that they do is good. Look at 8 verse 3. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Then in 10 verse 3, we read Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. Esther and Mordecai clearly loved their nation. They care for their fellow Jews, and they both risk much to save them. Now, that's good, isn't it? That's courageous. That's loving. Those are attitudes we want to see in our heroes. But the silence about God in this book, from all the characters, and particularly Esther and Mordecai, implies that they are ignorant or indifferent to God. And actually, that's what's at the root of their problems. Their behavior throughout the book is morally ambiguous. Mordecai, at the very start, encourages Esther to hide her Jewish identity. She is encouraged by Mordecai to sleep with a man who is not her husband, who is not a Jew. And Esther does all of this. She complies. And we read that she pleases the king more than any of the other virgins. Then Esther at first seems to prefer the luxury of the harem to putting her life on the line, only to change her mind because of what seems like a threat from Mordecai to reveal her secret, to show her who she is as a Jew. And in our passage this morning, things actually only get worse. And the first thing to think about is Esther's revenge. And King Xerxes, on hearing Esther's plea, sends out another edict, and that's what we read in 8 verse 11. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them or their women and children, and plunder the property of their enemies. Now let me say, the NIV, it is a good translation, but here it gets it quite wrong. What it does is connect the women and children to those who are being attacked. It shouldn't do that. In the Hebrew, the children and women are included along with the armed forces as those who the Jews are allowed to kill. What we have in 8:11 actually is a parallel of Haman's original edict in 3 verse 13. So let me just read them out and see if you can notice the similarities between the two. So in 3 verse 13 it says, to destroy, kill, and annihilate young and old, women and children in the one day, and to plunder their goods. Then in 8 verse 11, to destroy, kill, and to annihilate any armed forces of any people or province that might attack them, children and women included, and to plunder their goods. See, what the writer is trying to show us here is the complete turnaround that there is. What was to be done to the Jews, they are now given the right to do to those who would have done it to them. And that's exactly what they do. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did as they pleased to those who hated them. And we might say, well, what's the problem with this? Is that not justice? Well, no, I'm not sure it is. And I have to start this by saying, confessing really, that actually the whole idea of killing in the Old Testament, even the ones that God sanctions, leaves me uncomfortable, leaves me wishing that God would bring about his plan in a different way. But he does sanction it and remain good. How we make sense of that is a very interesting sermon for another day. But here, the silence is what causes us a problem. God doesn't sanction anything. They just do it. And I think that God has already saved his people in a subtle and surprising way by getting rid of Haman. I think Esther and Mordecai are carrying out what they think is justice. But one of the problems with that is that it can very easily become not justice, but revenge. And that's what we see with the second, when Esther approaches the king for the second time. She says, "If it pleases the king, give the Jews of Susa permission to carry out this edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows." Now, they're already dead. That's what we've just read, isn't it? And we could say, well, maybe it makes political sense for them to be hanged on the gallows. It's a public visual show that this is what happens to anyone who might rise up in rebellion against those who they might hold responsible for the death of Haman and his sons. But it doesn't make it any less cold or harsh or wrong. This is not justice. It's revenge. And I think the writer wants us to see that what Esther does is go beyond that parallel edict, where you might say an eye for an eye. Now she's taking more than that. So that's Esther's revenge. And then secondly, the fear of Mordecai. Now, this is a really interesting parallel. Mordecai receives the very things that Haman wanted. Fear of the people. Look at chapter 9, verses 2 and 3. The Jews assembled in their cities, in all the provinces of King Xerxes, to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them, because people of other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because fear of Mordecai had seized them. The desire to be feared and respected is what started this whole thing in the first place. And here Mordecai, who frankly should know better, is actually using it to advance himself. Let's not be naive here. Mordecai has risen to prominence. He's become something of a leader to the Jews. And they're assembled under his command, and they're assembled for a reason, to attack those, to fulfill the right they have with that edict. And what they do with that is they scare people. It's a fear tactic, and it's successful. But it's one which is wrong. And we look at this and we rightly ask, well, what's God doing? How can God bless people like this? And the answer is quite simply that God gets involved in the mess. More than that, he uses messed up people and their messed up ways to bring about his plan. Esther and Mordecai aren't unique as anti-heroes in the Old Testament, especially there are plenty to choose from. But what is unique about them, as we said before, is the silence of God and their silence about God. And I think that this is immediately relevant to the culture that we live in today, because although God does still do miraculous things, and I believe that with all my heart, certainly, at least in the West, it's not the sort of thing that we experience on an everyday basis, is it? The book of Esther shows us that when we don't hear this booming voice from heaven or have a prophet telling us what God would have us do, that we've got decisions to make ourselves as to what is the right thing to do. Did you notice in 8 verse 11 in that edict that is presented, Esther and Mordecai, the Jews, are given the right to defend themselves and kill those who stand against them? That's not a command, is it? That's a choice that they've got to make. Do they take that right or do they not take that right? Now, of course, to us living in 21st century UK, this is not a morally grey area, is it? But it must have been for them. They knew the history of their nation. They knew how their ancestors wiped out the Canaanites so they could possess the promised land, the very thing that God had promised to give them. It seemed right back then, so is it right now? That's the question that must have been in their minds. Now, we too, I suggest, have to make decisions which fall into that grey area. The grey areas are things that the Bible neither exhorts nor condemns. You know, so for example, things like getting drunk or cheating on your wife, they are not grey areas, are they? The Bible is pretty clear about those things, but other things are, whether we like it or not. Watching a particular movie, maybe, or going to a particular bar, allowing your children to play particular video games, or go to a particular party. Those are things which fall into that grey area. And what Esther and Mordecai are for us this morning are examples of how not to make decisions in these areas. They show us three things not to do. So firstly, they show us don't be silent before God. Now, I'm sure you're sick of hearing this, but as we said, God appears to be silent in this book, and its characters are silent about him and towards him. And here they're having to make this major decision, and nowhere do we see them take it to God. The only glimmer of prayer in the whole book is when they're fasting. And we can only presume that they prayed while they fasted. Now, the idea of being silent before God, that is a big mistake. As Christians, those adopted into God's family, we've got this incredible privilege to speak to God in prayer, to take the big things and the small things to him in prayer. And if we are to make good decisions when faced with choices in grey areas, then, well, that's exactly what we've got to do. We've got to bring them before God. We've got to wrestle before God about them. We've got to ask for his help to know what to do in those scenarios. So don't be silent before God. And secondly, don't be ignorant or indifferent to God. As we said, their silence about and towards God implies that they're either ignorant of him or indifferent to him. Israel's got this incredible history, doesn't it, of being chosen by God to be loved, to be his treasured possession, one who he does incredible things for in amazing power to show them who he is. Now, when that God is known and he reveals the things that pleases him, well, you want to do those things. And as you learn what pleases him, you can make better informed decisions in those grey areas. God's revealed himself, of course, to us most fully in the person of Jesus Christ, the one that everything else that has gone before is pointing to the need for. He shows us what God is like because he is God, and he shows us how to please God because that's what he lives for, isn't it? If we've had our series on the Gospel of John, and throughout he says, you know, I'm doing these things to bring glory to my Father's name. I'm here to glorify the Father, and he does it perfectly, doesn't he? He shows us what it looks like to please God. The Bible's been given to us that we might, through Jesus, know God and know what he desires from us. And the more we know about God, the more we understand what he's like, what his character is, then the more we'll see what pleases him, and the better we will be at making decisions in those grey areas. God has chosen to reveal himself through the Word of God. And if we want to know him, then we've got to be in it. Then the third thing that they show us is, don't make these decisions alone. Nowhere in the whole book of Esther do we have, as we often find in other books in the Old Testament, the Spirit coming upon anyone. They don't have the Spirit of God to direct them. Now, when we trust Christ, when we say, Jesus, I need you in my life, we receive his Spirit. And he does several things. And the first two things that he does is help us with what we've just said. He helps us not to be silent before God. In Romans 8, we read that when we don't know what to pray for, that the Spirit intercedes. He helps us. And he helps us not to be ignorant nor indifferent towards God, because he's the one who's leading us into truth. He's the one who's convicting us of our sin, showing us our need for Jesus. And he also helps us and shows us what the Bible means. He stirs up joy in our hearts as we learn about God. And then thirdly, he's at work within us. He's transforming us to be like Jesus. And as this happens, we progressively make choices that most honor God more frequently. Now, of course, when it's said like this, it all sounds dead easy, doesn't it? Let's just pray. Let's just read. Let's just allow the Spirit to work in us. But it's not easy, is it? It's hard. It's really hard. It's difficult to lay down our lives and allow the Spirit to work in us because we want to keep them. We want to keep control of them. And it's difficult to spend time in prayer. It's difficult to spend time studying the Bible. They're called disciplines for a reason, because disciplines involve effort. And this is the big challenge for me this week from this passage. How much effort do I actually put in when it comes to making decisions in these grey areas? How much do I think about the choices I make? How lightly do I make them? I've been convicted this week of times I've not made good choices. I look back at some of the things that I've done in my life and the consequences of them, and I'm amazed at my idioticness. So as I finish this series, as we finish this series, let's take that challenge on. How much effort do I actually put in when it comes to making decisions in these grey areas? How much do I think about the choices I make? How lightly do I make them? I know that I have to think more about these things. That I need to spend more time thinking about God's character and what pleases him with reference to him. I know that I've got to spend more time praying about these things. And I wonder this morning if that's you as well. So shall we just take a moment or two? I presume we've got a final song to sing, but let's just take a moment or two to think about those things, and then the band will come, hopefully, and lead us in a final song.